It's okay to be me on bad days, and it's okay to be me on good days, and it's okay to be me.
This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives.
Hey folks, I'm Elise, your producer, and today we are welcoming Christopher Mendez as our guest today. Chris has a variety of professional experience in the fields of naval military security, middle and high school instruction, higher education, as well as refugee case management and more restorative justice practices. Before we get into this episode, I'd like to let you know that we are hosting a Decolonized Dia de los Muertos workshop on Saturday, October 23rd at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. This workshop will discuss the distinctions between the way Dia de los Muertos is celebrated across Latin America, as well as its indigenous origins and the present-day commodification of Latinx cultures. All the information you'll need is in the show notes below, and without further ado, let's get into this episode.
Chris, welcome to This Restorative Justice Life. Who are you?
I am a son of Shirley Benedict and Jesus Mendez. I'm the brother of Jonathan and Melissa. I am a niece. I am a nephew to Lynette and Cedar and Maria and Anna and many more. I am a father to Sadine and Muhammad and Jazza and Isa and Musa. So anybody who's listening to this, please excuse my babies crying and screaming and playing in the background, children being their vibrant selves, living life. And I'm a husband to Kiran. That is who I am.
Who are you?
I am Costa Rican. I am Latino, I'm Hispanic, I'm indigenous, I am both the colonizer and the colonized. I am the product of hateful colonialism.
Who are you?
I'm a flawed person. I am a short temper. I am at times an oversized ego, and I am at times an overcommitting person.
Who are you?
I'm a strong person. I am bright and smart. I am all of the feelings in the world at all times. I'm a big heart, and I am a solid yes and openness to new experiences.
Who are you?
I am also Yusuf Abdullah, a member of the Muslim community, a follower of the Islamic faith, and a servant of my creator.
Who are you?
I am what I need to be in the moment.
And finally, who are you?
And I am whatever my creator guides me to be.
Thank you so much, Chris, Yusuf. It is so good to meet you. You know, you've been tagged in by one of our former guests, Becky, and it's really good to get to meet you in the space. I'm really excited about getting to explore all those intersections of who you are and learn more about your journey. But it's always good to check in. So to the fullest extent that you want to answer the question, how are you?
I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, Becky is somebody who I hold near and dear to my heart. She It's just wonderful. Somebody who's really kind of been that restorative mirror at times, a partner and doing the work. But I'm doing all right. I'm at this really weird intersection in life where things seem to be going pretty good professionally, I would say, and personally. But I'm at this crossroads with my own sort of mental health. There's no other way to put it. And I hesitated to even say that because, I've always kind of just struggled with my own ADHD, and my parents were kind of against labeling and getting, you know, medications and things of that nature. So I know for a fact through a very strong hand, I was able to do well when I was young in school. I think it was that fear-driven performance. And also I was able to get by with being a smart kid. But as an adult now, I find myself at this really weird place where, like, I find that my ADHD, now it's starting to make sense of all of my experiences in life and all my struggles right now. And so the structure that I've always given myself to kind of keep myself busy and keep myself overwhelmed so that I can be productive and I can feel good, is no longer there because I'm on family leave. I have a 4-month-old who my wife took 3 months and now I'm taking 3 months. And so I find myself without that overwhelming workload on a daily basis. And it has me at this really weird place where I'm starting to second guess my own sanity. I'm starting to second guess who I am as a person. And it just has me like also draw the red line and saying, it's okay to go see a mental health professional about this and to either seek some combination of like strategies / medication or whatever it may be. So yeah, that's how I'm doing. But overall good, you know, I started throughout life there, and I would say I've discovered this in my 20s. And so it's been a big part of me, I would say for 20 years, but really big time for the last 10 years is weightlifting, whether it's CrossFit or powerlifting. It's been my therapy. It allows me to be in the moment and it allows me to like just focus on something. And it also gives me a physical manifestation, whatever energies I have inside myself that I need to expel. And so this week I was able to get back on a program that I really enjoyed last winter. And so I had 2 really good days of some really heavy lifting, just blasting some old like late 90s, early 2000s, you know, rap and hip hop. And so, yeah, that has me feeling good this week at least.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Just like listening to your response, I am resonating so much for a couple reasons. Some that I didn't think that I would be sharing publicly, but here we go. We're having a conversation. It's just you and me. You know, I'm an expectant father, right? 6 months from, you know, when we're recording right now, probably 5 months from when this is being released. Awesome. And so a lot of my energy right now is like preparing for that, preparing like as a solopreneur, entrepreneur, like thinking about like, what are the things that I'm going to need to do in order to be able to take that leave? People who've been listening to this podcast, and if it's coming out in the order that I think it was, you might have heard over the last couple of weeks that September has been a month where I've pulled back a lot. And so that moment of pause, while it hasn't looked like no work, just relaxation, like I launched another podcast in the month of September, right? Like the Diversity and Inclusion Revolution or Reform, like with my partner in that, Connie. But it didn't look like going out and like facilitating and doing all that kind of work. And so that sense of like, you know, your work not defining you is something that like I really am really conscious of, and like still needing to like fight like that drive to like be a quote unquote productive member of society and like having your identity wrapped up in that. So I feel all of that. And, you know, building those habits, those structures in your life, whether that is weightlifting, whether that's something else, to have the ability to find your roots is super important. So thank you for sharing and thank you for bringing that out of me.
Absolutely. Congratulations. Yeah. And this is your first child?
Yes, this will be our first. Yeah.
Oh man, each kid is their own person. Like we forget that, even as you know, even we see them as such little beings without agency, that we really forget they're whole human beings with their own agency, even as infants. And, you know, like, they're just doing their thing. And like, I've learned the hard way, like, I can't treat my first the same I treat my third. Like, I have two girls and like, they're day and night, you know? And it's just like, okay, like, I need to recognize what works for one is not going to work for the other. So I've learned the hard way that like, I take advice with an open heart and open mind, but at the same time, I'm like, yeah, I'm also going to just let my kids kind of guide me and how to be a better father.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that like you were saying as you were checking in that resonated with is like, I restarted again, going to therapy. Right. Nice. And I was talking with my therapist earlier today about like my lack of emotional availability. Right. And like being able to empathize with someone who's experienced like that I don't have. And like, while I'm able to do that professionally in the context of restorative justice, which we'll talk about in a little bit, right? Like being able to hold space, it's different when those are people in your life, where like, it's not just like, all right, we went through this process together and I was able to construct this space where you can work through your feelings. That's different than like, oh, actually having to live it in the day to day. And this being like this restorative justice life, we know like one of the things that I appreciate about you is like, you've done this work in lots and lots of different settings. And so maybe this is just like that transition into, you know, you've been doing this work for a long time, maybe even before you knew the words. So how did this journey get started for you?
No, absolutely. And I want to tell you that you're not alone in that. That's one thing that I've like, I've actually just recently come to the, I had that like moment of clarity that I understood why does repeatedly people refer to and describe restorative practices, in particular circle, as therapeutic? Oh man, this is kind of like therapy. Oh, this is therapeutic. And the truth of the matter is like, when you find yourself in a solid therapeutic relationship, you are in a safe place to share your true and honest self and process through things. And like, when I find myself in a really good solid circle space, I'm able to share and I don't have a feeling or an anxiety of loss. And that also brings me to like the fact of like, I have that, you know, like probably my biggest liability as a husband and a partner is that I'm a restorative practitioner, because that's what my wife is going to hold against me. Like, you hold space for people in such vulnerable ways. How come you're not able to hold space with me in that vulnerable way? And I've just come to the real like life acceptance. And like, it's a shitty acceptance, but it's the acceptance that I have a whole lot more to lose in my personal relationship than I am in professional relationships or in circle. Like my life of like, and I don't want to say just trauma, but like my life of like all the good things and all the bad things combined has prepared me to like, I'm always ready to walk away from everything, from anything material or social or emotional. Like, I'm ready for loss. And when I have to deal with that in a personal way, like that's, I don't want to have to lose my relationships. So yeah, I'm not going to be able to open up as much, because I feel like if you get to know the true me, like, you're going to be scared of me and you're going to walk away. And so that's terrifying to me. But it's, I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, for me, technically explicitly, I've been a restorative practitioner since August of 2017. Right. But when I look at my life and like the different, I'm at a stage in life where I'm holding onto a rope right now. But I look back now 10, 15, 20 years ago, and I was holding onto threads. And now I've been able to get to the point where like these different threads of my life experiences have been braided together. And now they're a strong rope that I'm able to do a lot with. But I would say, I mean, my upbringing is restorative. Like, I come from, you know, whether they know it or not, like, you know, whether it's recognized or not, right? Because colonialism has been really effective at like erasing our indigenous roots, right? But like the way I was raised by my grandmother and my grandfather, like sitting and storytelling, like that right there is like, you know, it took me a while to realize like, oh man, like we did circling with my family, like every afternoon at the coffee table, and everybody was allowed to speak, including the children. So it was, you know, I would say like that's the beginning of it. But I would say explicitly, like, I would probably say is connecting to community beyond, is when I became Muslim in 2006. I started to become more active in community activism and organizing. And that led me to my first like real youth work. And that was the local Islamic schools in South Florida didn't have, I'm originally from South Florida. And they didn't have, there were several Islamic schools, but they were so small, they didn't have like sports teams and they weren't able to play with other kids. So like me and a bunch of other like young brothers and sisters were like, yo, like this sucks. Like we played, you know, all these sports in public high school and middle school, like these kids don't get to do that. And they were like, yeah, well, there's enough schools. Why they can just play each other. And we're like, yo, let's make a sports league. And literally that's what we did. And we started off with soccer and I was known as Coach Yusuf. Like I was that really crazy, like mid-20s, high energy, screaming, scaring the crap out of little kids. My students would like later tell me like, yo, we remember you and you scared the crap out of us, but you're so cool. Like we didn't know you were cool like that, but we just saw you as the coach for the other team. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, I didn't mean to scare you. Like, no, but you were cool. I'm like, all right, I guess. But that started me with youth work. And that led me to my first teaching position. I taught for at Islamic schools down in South Florida for a while. And I left that mainly because I have problems with institutions and with rules and like, I'm in the moment, in the relationship kind of guy. And like your rules like really do mean shit to me most of the time. And like properness and people's expectations really like aren't as important as like the moment and the needs of the moment and like relationships with people and particularly vulnerable people, kids, right? And so, but I joke around and I say like, I've sucked as an instructor. My teachers, my sister's a teacher, a math and science teacher, and she rocks. Like pedagogically, like her instruction is on point. I wasn't there. Like I sucked as a teacher. I admit it. Like on my best day, I was probably mediocre on my best day. But most of the time I sucked. But what I was really good at is being with the kids. What I was really good at is having solid foundations of trust and respect with these kids to where like, they were coming to me with their deepest, darkest things and like, yo, I need help. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, let's figure this out then. And I would say that that's where it started. Like, I would say officially, because like, I remember my last principal, he would be like, yeah, you're my go-to, like you just handle it. I trust you and just come and update me. And so it was nice to have that kind of role, unofficial role of like, hey, our most difficult student, we want you to like be partners with them. I'm like, yeah, of course. That's my little buddy. And like, I would develop an authentic relationship and friendship with this young person. And I would look at the adults like, why can't you like, and now I understand what I was doing. Back then I was just being me. I was just being in the moment, right? But I would say that's where it started. And that trajectory, during that same time, you know, I was, and I've been all over the place, like professionally, you know, earlier on, I graduated high school and so let me sort of break down the academic portion of it because that was a huge portion to like how I got to where I am also, right? Like I got out of high school and like I sucked at high school. I barely graduated, not because I wasn't smart and I couldn't do it, just because I had other shit going on in my life at the moment and school was not really a big priority. And so I graduated and I went into the Navy, got out. And it was in the Navy that I took my sociology class with this small little Filipino officer who was like mean as shit when he worked. But like when you got to know him, he was like the coolest professor. And like he really expanded my brain to like learning. I'm like, yo, I like school. I like learning. Like this is what I used to love reading. And so I got out of the Navy and I started going to school and I got my bachelor's in social psychology. At the time I had this like really fondness for small group dynamics, in particular, like having been in the Navy, like I would be on teams with people who personally I hated them. But when we were in uniform, like, hey, you can trust me with your life. And I know I can trust my life in your hands. And so like, even though we didn't get along, like somehow there was this attachment, somehow there was this really firm relationship. And that like blew my mind. And like, I was just fond of it, right? Like intrigued. And so at the time I was looking for work. I got a job at like a local university down in South Florida, Nova Southeastern. And I thought I wanted to do like a psych degree in like research in small group dynamics. And sure enough, they didn't have anything. And I found they had a PhD and a master's and a PhD program in conflict analysis and resolution. So I was like, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. Like, let me dig into a class or two. And sure enough, like, I was like, yo, this is really dope. Like, I like this. And I just kept pursuing it. And eventually, you know, I through a couple of roller coaster rides in life, I finished my PhD in 2014. My dissertation was on a female child soldier coming out of Nicaragua who didn't officially go through a DDR program, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration program, but rather she just relied on her family. And statistically, that she should have been a felon, a sex worker, a drug addict, and in abusive relationships. And she, for the most part, she was none of those things. So statistically, she was just like, whoa, exceptional, right? But like, she didn't go through a program. So what was it? At the time, I didn't understand like what my, I still understand like that person is a family member to me. So I always grew up with the stories of that other persona, of that experience. So I was always curious to know about that. But also what blew my mind is like, you're normal. Like, how is that possible? And so when I look back now, I'm like, I had a fondness for vulnerable populations, for youth, and for what are the organic community supports that allow us to succeed, right? Like, it's all restorative in nature, and I just didn't really realize it. But when I finished my PhD program, I was overqualified academically, but underqualified professionally to step anywhere into any kind of conflict resolution work. And so I found myself in like the deepest, probably one of the darkest periods of my life, where I was like unemployed for a year. My third child was being born and like, I didn't have anything. And that's how I found myself up in Minnesota. There was an AmeriCorps position and I'm like, yo, AmeriCorps is like $700, $800 a month. But guess what? I'm not making anything right now. Do I risk this? And you know, me and the wife planned it out and came up here, and you know, the rest is history. I've stayed up here in Minnesota since then. You know, we're going, 2017. Yeah, we're going on 4 years. Yeah, 4 years up here. And I've been able to tie all of my life experiences all together and like, oh, that's how this all comes together. So I would say like, that's kind of the trajectory that I find myself. Like, those are the different sort of starting points, the different parts of my restorative practices coming together.
Yeah, I want to go back. What's funny, you're not the only person who does this, like, because, you know, in Circle, like, we don't interrupt each other, right? But like, there are all these flashpoints in there that I would love to like latch onto. I think the one that's most that's standing out right now is when you're talking about like your introduction to this work, sitting around the table sharing stories, and then when you're looking at this young person and looking for the quote-unquote organic supports, right? That reminds me that, you know, this work is how humans want to be together. When things are good, like, this is how humans are together. And, you know, thanks to colonialism, imperialism, late stage global capitalism, all these other things, we're separated from those things, right? You think about the teachers who like were marveling at you, like, how are you building such relationships with these students, right? Like, the reason that they aren't able to is, right, because of the pressures of capitalism, instructional goals, right, and like all these standards that they're trying to hit, that they've been trained to do as teachers, right? And that's not the natural way, the organic way, the way that like we were meant to be in good relationship with each other. I'm curious, like, when you think about the way that you developed, was there someone or something that was like relationship driving you, or is that just something that you felt was coming to you naturally?
I think it came, something that came to me naturally. There's nothing like off the top of my head that I could think of. I think there was just a really inherent drive in me from my own like upbringing that young people are their own people, right? Like, we cannot look at them as these, like, just small little human containers that we're filling with knowledge and with manners and with facts and with ways of being, and then they're gonna, you know, be full with what we give them, and then they're gonna be these replicas of, or these creations of what we want them to be. Like, it was always recognize them as an individual human being that really drove me. I in particular remember one of the things that I was taught like middle school, high school. So it's that really weird age, right? Like, middle school is kind of like an alien phase, and in high school is just that this rebellion phase. In Islamic thought, the age of accountability is not based on a number, but the age of accountability, right? Like, when we're talking about in the big theological sense, and even early on in early stages of like, historically in Muslim communities, even and this is found within all human history, right? But within everyday practice, the age of accountability comes about with puberty, right? So, like, if we look at historically, we've always prepared human beings to be, for the most part, sovereign individuals by the time that they reach puberty, right? Like, and so now we find problematic now when we think about, like, a young person going through puberty and all of a sudden that young girl is being married off or something, right? Like, that can be problematic for us today. But if we think about, like, young men and women were trained and conditioned and prepared to be adults by the time they reached that age, then they were able to act in better ways. But I say all that to say, right, like, at the foundation of it, you know, I always gave that a lot of thought, because what that tells me, right, like, it's not just theologically that there's an age of accountability. What really, really drove me is this, like, there is a physiological function. There's a physiological change in a person's body that says, hey, you are mature now. Right? Like, and if we don't think that our physiological existence doesn't affect our psychological existence, then we're greatly, greatly, greatly overlooking and simplifying our human existence, right? Like, these little kids, like, teenagers have this big rebellious phase. Why? Because we want to tell them what to do when their body is telling them and telling their brains that, like, hey, you should tell yourself what to do, because you're getting to be an adult now, right? And so, like, my conversation would always, like, hey, yeah, like, they're kind of like little adults, right? Like, they're getting into their own of decision making. My job is not to tell you what to do. My job is to help you make better decisions. And, like, even with my own children, that's been my approach. Like, okay, I'm just here to help you make better decisions. I'm not here to tell you what to do, right? Yeah, does that at times with my 2-year-old or my 5-year-old mean I have to tell them what to do in a moment? Yes, but their general life trajectory? No, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just here to support you and being the best person that you can be. So what is it that you want to do, right? So for me, yeah, that's what drove me, I guess, is agency. I guess I would boil it down to recognizing their humanity and their agency, and mean, like, I'm not going to see you as a passive existence. You're your own person. Like, how do we do this together?
Do you feel like you had that as a child?
I feel like I did. I was brought up with very strict expectations, right? Like, you know, I was expected to give, like, I'll give the example. I was expected to deliver academically on a consistent basis, right? Being the child of immigrants, right? Like, I'm the oldest of all my cousins and siblings, being blue collar, you know, immigrants from Central America, I was expected to academically deliver, because that's education is the ticket, right? So, but I was also given a lot of free range to engage in, like, great philosophical and political debate with my uncle, with my grandfather, with my mother. Like, yeah, I wasn't allowed to be disrespectful, but I was allowed to engage in conversation, and I was allowed to be my person. And so I do think that I was given that in my upbringing, without a doubt.
Yeah, no, and so what I'm thinking about, like, do things come naturally, quote unquote, right? The whole, like, nature versus nurture versus, you know, I know yeah. life experiences are nurture, even though people might not have intentionally been nurturing those thought patterns and those behaviors, but they're even in your upbringing, there does seem to be something about, like, you know, we have the ability to, like, the inherent human dignity that people have, no matter who they are, translates into so many different ways. I don't know that that was entirely affirmed by your experience in the Navy, but when you're thinking about the ways that you have gone on to think about this work that we're participating in around conflict, around youth, around working with people who are on the margins or who have been oppressed, like, that definitely translates so much. I'm curious, when you think about how you're, you know, you said, like, all of your life experiences compounded and, like, brought you to this point. How would you describe this point? Because, like, as you said, like, and Elise read in your bio, you know, you're now working at, like, this Legal Rights Center. What is your work like there?
All right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm always, you know, I'm very self-deprecating when you That is my go-to. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm still trying to figure it out. So that was my first thought when you asked. So, you know, what is this moment? This moment is I'm trying to figure out, like, what am I doing with my life? You know, like, what do I want to be when I grow up? But my day-to-day, like, so right now I'm at the Legal Rights Center as a restorative facilitator / youth advocate. And day-to-day that entails just facilitating restorative processes, sometimes conferences. We primarily use family conference, but sometimes it's circle, sometimes it's just some, you know, what I would call restorative dialogues, and sometimes it's just restorative facilitation in the sense of, like, where I'm literally facilitating information from one to another, from one person to another, asynchronous, and all of a sudden they have this connection, like, oh, okay, bam, and then they can do it themselves. And so, like, that's, you know, prior to my leave, that was my day to day. So that entails getting, you know, we have partnerships with different, the two biggest school districts with Minneapolis and St. Paul. But we also have some contracts with the county attorneys for their truancy programs and things like that. And so we get a lot of the referral cases like that. We're also in the community, so we get a lot of family referrals. Where families are like, yo, you did really, you know, and it happens often where, like, mom will be called me up and, like, hey, you've really helped me out big time with my older son. I'm having this issue with my younger daughter at school. Can you help me out here? And so those situations occur, and we're there to, like, oh yeah, let's figure out this. How do we connect you with the school? And specifically within the Legal Rights Center, like, our conferencing, and this is how I see most restorative interventions as a cast, right? Like, a relationship, that bone has been broken. As a restorative facilitator, I come in with solid communication, with solid empathy-based, relationship-based ways of connecting. And I help teachers and administrators and professionals and young people and family sit down and connect with each other so that that relationship, that bone, can be healed. And soon as that bone is healed, I'm stepping away. It might not be fully healed, but it's good enough to where they can hold on their own. I need to step away, because if not, if I stay too long, atrophy occurs. And then I'm just a detriment. I just become the crutch for that young person. I become that communication crutch for that social worker that doesn't know how to connect with mom. Like, I'm not here to do that. I'm here to help people be better themselves and have better relationships. And sometimes those better relationships, right? And it happens often with schools and with systems, right? Because our education is inherently dehumanizing. Like, it is a factory. It is a factory for factory workers. Like, that's what it was created for. That's what it's designed for. And that's what it does today. So it's dehumanizing by its very design and its very nature, despite the fact of the best intentions and the best practices by individual professionals. So a lot of times, like, that means just, like, checking adults, like, yo, stop being a shitty person. Like, just because you have a degree and a title, like, And I joke around, like, that's why I don't even use my like PhD or anything. Like, I don't go by doctor. I just go by Chris. I'm like super informal because I like keeping that in my back pocket. So when I see adults getting out of pocket, I got to check them, like, oh yeah, here, let me remind you, I'm a PhD, and you want to use some big language, we can use some big language. You want to talk about research, we can talk. And like, you want to make people feel dumb, I can do that too. Let's play that game. I'm really good at it. And so to like level out that power, because it needs to be leveled out sometimes, because the system is inherently, it's not broken, it's just shitty, right? And so day to day, that's what it looks like. But that also entails a whole lot of like professional development, right? With school systems, with other sort of practitioners in the metro area across Minnesota. I've done some other like, you know, random work with sort of state groups to do listening sessions with youth and things. But like right now, I look at every opportunity I can to engage in a more restorative way, to learn more about being more restorative, right? Like I try to do the same thing that you're doing here, is and capture the stories of other restorative practitioners so that we can highlight people doing good work out there. And so that was the same things. Like for me, it's storytelling. It's not about a radio show. It's about, I'm being selfish. I want to listen to somebody's kick-ass story, and I want to share that kick-ass story with other people. And so like storytelling is restorative.
So much in there. One, really quickly plug your radio show for people who just happen to be in the Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul area.
Absolutely. Just Us. And so big shout out to Rick Kelly out in Canada. Well, I got that from him. He got it from a young person who said, you know, justice is just us. You know, this is just us. So it's a wordplay, right? But Just Us Building Restorative Community at KRSM. It's a 98.9. It's a Southside Minneapolis radio station, community-based, mainly BIPOC, a whole lot of LGBTQ, just very community-based programming. And I'll be honest, I kind of took a hiatus for like a year, maybe a little bit more than a year, because of the pandemic. It just really threw me for a loop. But I'm getting back on my grind, and shout out to Andrea Pierre, the station manager, for just a lot, you know, giving me the space to relaunch and get things going. So yeah, KRSM, Just Us.
Shout out. Now with those stories in mind, you kind of mentioned like three areas in which you work, right? Families, communities, right? Schools, criminal legal. I'm curious, keeping confidentiality in mind and like the respect of those folks, I'm curious if there are any stories of processes that you've helped facilitate or experienced that stand out to you that you'd be willing to share.
I remember one of my darkest days as a restorative practitioner was probably also one of my like best days as a restorative practitioner. The incident was public knowledge, right? But I was a restorative practitioner at another organization at CMRS, which is also in the Twin Cities. And I was at one of the Robbinsdale area schools. It's called Cooper High. And there was a fire that day at the school in one of the bathrooms or something. And there was a bunch of layers of failure. But what ended up happening that day was they corralled all the kids onto the football field, which is fenced in. And what ended up happening is you had the whole high school, which is mainly BIPOC kids, right? Which is a big thing in the state of Minnesota, which is 89.9% white, mm-hmm. right? Like there are not a lot of black and brown spaces. Like that's just a fact. So when you have those spaces, it's like, oh, what? So anyways, this high school, you know, so you have this huge student population. They're already, you know, the sirens are going off, the noises, everything. So people are already on like high alert. They're triggered. I, as an adult, was triggered. And so we're out there, and all of the majority of these educators did not find, I'll say it openly, the majority of the educators were white, and majority of them were not inside with the kids. They were outside of they were even outside of the fence. Not only along the outside of like the track, but they were most of them were outside of the fence. And I'm not going to lie to you, it felt like a prison. You had these black and brown bodies behind a fence and white adult bodies looking in, supervising. And so I found myself in, because I'm like, yo, like, nah, like you're with people. And so me and a couple of other, and funny enough, Black and brown folks, professionals, were in there and we're talking to the kids. And all of a sudden, first fight breaks out. I'm not even a student. I'm not even a school employee. And I'm running, breaking up the fights. And it's just one fight and another fight and another fight and another fight. And like 6 or 7 fights break out in a matter of like 30 minutes, 45 minutes, till it finally ended where this young student got like punched and like sucker punched and like knocked out cold, to where they, you know, they're on the floor and they're shaking a little bit. And that's what wakes up all the educators, and they come in and they surround this girl. And I'm like, yo, it's too late now. Like, where were you before? Like, why weren't you checking in on kids? Like, hey, how are you doing? How are y'all doing? Like, what do you need? Like, you weren't with kids, right? And so that was a really, and I'll tell you why that was a low point for me, is because, and it didn't hit me in the moment. In the moment, like in crises, I'm phenomenal. I'm numb. Like my life experiences had prepared me to where I'm really good in crises. Like that doesn't faze me. But it was after everything died down, the kids are let go, they're going home. And I say goodbye to a group of like these 9th grade girls that I was also doing circle with at the time. We were actually in circle when the fire alarm went off. And so they're like, all right, bye, Mr. Chris, da da da. They leave. And one of my kids who I had done a restorative conference with comes up to me. And he was known to run with cliques in the school and the neighborhood in particular. And he just comes to me, he's like, hey, yo, and I'm talking to him. And I never pushed him to go either way. I shared who I was with him, and I never judged him for who he was. So he was really open and cool with me. And he just comes up to me because he's like, I just want to do better. And so like, I stayed like with the relationship with him. And he's like, yo, I got to tell you this. I mean, he's like smiling. And I'm like, yo, what's up? Like, what's good, man? Like, what's happening? He's like, yeah, man. So I finally did it. I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, what's up? He's like, yeah. I sold my piece. I sold it yesterday, bro. Like, I'm done. Like, I don't want to be carrying that around. And I don't want to be doing that anymore. I'm like, yo, like, for a kid whose safety depends on having a piece on him, for him to come tell me he did that, like, that's next level commitment to change and to growth that, like, most adults would never understand. Like, most adults will never, never understand that kind of commitment. And like, I just remember, like, I was filled with this joy. Like, I hugged him like he was my son. Like, I'm like, bro, like, I'm so happy for you. Like, yo, but if you need anything, you let me know. Like, you have my cell phone number. Like, hit me up. But like, I'm super proud of you. Like, that's what's up. And so it's like this freaking high. But then the adrenaline wears off. And then I just bust out into tears, because this young man just showed like the greatest sense of humanity that anybody could show, which is, I am committing to not unnecessarily causing harm to other individuals, while at the same time, a system of education, which is supposed to foster growth and safety and security, was treating my young Black and brown kids like animals behind a fence. And like, I couldn't even control it. I just was crying for like probably half an hour. And like some of my girls saw me from a distance and they came up like, Mr. Chris. I'm like, oh no, I'm fine. I'm just, you know, I'm just tired. I'm worked up. I'm like, I'm good. So like, I was like, okay, I need to get away from here. And I saw one of my other like peoples in the building. I was like, hey, I gotta go. And they're like, you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'll call you later. We'll talk about it. And so I got in the car. I cried. I went to the office. I cried. And like, I had to get that off. Cause I'm like I said, it's that high. Like, he's showing for me, a pinnacle of humanity, while the system is treating them like animals. And like, yeah, just, I mean, that was in one single day within a matter of hours. And like, it for me, it was still one of those defining moments, like, yo, systems are crap. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. When you thought about, you know, your students of color being, you know, behind those cages as during that fire drill, right? I thought a lot about, like, you know, the relationship between like individuals and the community. Was that ever addressed?
So it was never addressed in the sense of like, well, we're going to do something for the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, there was follow-up, you know, of like, oh, we need to have better plans for fire drills and for emergencies and this, that, the third. And there was, you know, we held a processing circle. I don't want to say it was a healing circle because we weren't trying to seek, at least there was a good group of BIPOC professionals in the building that felt deeply harmed, that felt like I felt harmed because I saw my kids being harmed in ways that they probably didn't even recognize right away. Right. But so we had a processing circle and a few of the white educators showed up, not a lot. I'll be honest with you. It was like a handful. And we're talking about a high school with like a few dozen educators. Right. And there was a handful. But I was grateful for that processing circle. And shout outs to the keeper of that one. That was a dear friend of mine. But what I was able to walk away with, and it was a good reminder for myself, right? That one of the educators was saying like, you know, I never even thought about that. That's how this looked, right? Like I, as an educator, as a white educator, was standing outside of the fence talking with my colleagues, and my kids were in there dysregulated and things were popping off and I didn't go in there, or I wasn't in there in the first place. But the only thing that I was on my mind was I never get downtime to talk with my colleagues, and it was a time to connect. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of explaining themselves, and they were like, it doesn't make it right, but I just want to tell you what was going through my mind. And so for me, like, to recognize their humanity in those moments, despite the fact that there was significant harm done, it allowed me to look at them as humans again, instead of as these monsters that were harming kids, right? It made me see them like their unintentional actions were causing harm to other people. And for me, as a person, like that is something huge we come across. And as restorative practitioners, we recognize intent versus impact, right? And we try to call that out. But as people, we don't often get to process that intent versus impact. Like, you know, and I still, to this day, one of my favorites is Will Smith's, you know, responsibilities versus faults video. He has a really dope video explaining it. And I'm like, yo, like, I still use it with my kids a lot of times. Like, listen, don't tell me it's not your fault. Like, is it your responsibility? That's what you need to be asking yourself. And so intent versus impact sometimes, you know, it made me see them as humans. And so like we had that circle, that processing circle, but it didn't go beyond that I know of. And that was my last year at that school. After that, I moved over to Legal Rights Center.
Gotcha. One of the things that you said at the end of your story is like that's the system. And for me, one of the reasons that Amplifier J has started is because I like didn't want to work within those systems anymore. Right. And so right now for me, literally amplifying the work is informing people who work in the systems, right? Like these are the different ways that you can move and subvert like the ways that that continues to happen. What do you see as your role?
And this is the hard part, right? But like as I know that my personal role as me, as Christopher Mendez, as Yusuf, is one thing. And I understand the organizations is another. And there's there is overlap, but I would describe my role as subversive. Like my role is to plug in this coded virus, right? Like I'm, you know, thinking about Independence Day when Will Smith and I forgot the guy's name, but yeah, like they find a little spaceship, they plug into the mothership and they upload that virus, right? Like I'm plugging in a restorative virus. Like my job is to drop those seeds of restorative being into every single adult and every single youth that I can ever come across. And it might not bloom today or tomorrow. It might not bloom next year, but the hope is that eventually those seeds will bloom and we will have shifts in restorative ways of being. Because the truth of the matter is, I don't believe that I can reform a system. Like a system that's designed improperly will always, or a system that's designed to do things will always do that unless we change the system, right? But when enough people within that system, like, oh, okay, like, yo, nah, this is not what we want, and change directions completely, then that could happen. And so my job is to do that. My job is to like expose them. And like, one of my favorite things when I say, when I'm like, and sometimes like, I know Minnesota white people sometimes get pissed off at me because I'm just a little bit too like up. It's very passive aggressive up here. And like, so like my being up front and sometimes very like harsh rubs them the wrong way. But, you know, I have a general rule that like, as an educator, if you're not breaking the rule or bending the rule on a daily basis, you're probably a shitty educator. Like that is my rule. Like, no, this system is not humanizing. It is actually dehumanizing. So if on a daily basis, you're not finding rules that you have to break and bend in order to best serve your students, you're probably not doing right by your students. You're doing right by your job. You're doing right by the district. You're doing right by the curriculum. You're doing right by your paycheck, but you're not doing right by those kids. Like, there, it doesn't have to be anything major, right? Like, or controversial, but there has to be some bending or breaking, because the rules that are in place in that system are dehumanizing. So that's what I'm trying to get people to shift towards, right? Like, nah, like, root yourself in relationships. Because when we get enough people to start second guessing the system itself, like right now, I need people to second guess their practice. And when we get enough people to second guess their practice, they start to second guess the system. And once the system starts to get second guess, then now we can change it, right? And that'll have to happen eventually. That or it all burns down, right? Like, we just have societal collapse, and then we have something else that we have to build from the ground up. That was a little bit too dark and post-apocalyptic there, but you know, there's always that dark road, that dark option, that dark storyline that exists, right? Like, empires collapse. That is part of what history tells us. And there's been some really dark eras in human history. So, you know, when we start to take that into account, right? Like, to be restorative is also to think not only about deconstructing, but about constructing. And so, like, what does it look like to think about the systems not being there and being and constructing things independently? And we have to actually play that out in our heads. Like, the one thing I really love, like when I come across restorative practitioners, right? Like, who tell me like, oh, these systems need to all go. I'm like, I'm with you. Okay, but magic wand tomorrow, no more carceral state, no more education system. What happens tomorrow? Yeah, you're so focused on burning shit down and taking down, but you're not really also focused on building up. You're so focused on reforming that you don't know what you want to reform it to. And so I don't know, like I know I'm on a ramble right now, but like that's where my thoughts are going.
No, I guess like from that dark space, like what keeps you hopeful?
I think human history, like humanity has always shined, right? Like I don't think dark spaces are necessarily dark, you know, dark storylines are dark storylines. They're dark storylines for some people, right? But like, there's always growth, right? Like, it's just about whether it's intentional growth, right? Like, so for me, you know, I always think I love nature-based, you know, examples, but I'm like, I've been joking around with my daughter. She's recently shifted over to like mainly a plant-based diet. And I'm like, yo, I'm happy for you. I support you. I'm like, yeah, but you know, your plants actually eat animals that die. So your plants are meat eaters, but you're a plant eater. So that makes you me. So I'm like joking around with her, right? And then she's like, oh my God, dad, like, just shut up, like, stop. But I also think, you know, let's think about even human existence. You know, my parents, my family's from Costa Rica, right? And everybody holds this up as this like, oh, look at this beautiful, you know, nation in Central America with all this beautiful ecotourism. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's all great. And look, they have no army and they're so peaceful. I'm like, yeah, you know how that happened? A civil war and the right people won. And I'm like, that's a fact. Like, more than 2,000 people died, which back in those days when they were using like some outdated artillery. You know, this is 1948, so they didn't have American, you know, armaments. I'm like, a civil war happened, people died, but the right people won. I'm like, that's exactly what happened. I'm like, there's always the possibility, even after something dark, for something good to happen. You know, just as a forest is like in Everglades. I'm from South Florida, right? Like, there are pine trees that whose seeds don't open up unless there's a fire. Like, that is part of nature. That is part of our human existence, right? So sometimes, like, there needs to be some darkness, right? Like what we would call darkness, some discomfort, some pain, for there to be better things, for there to be growth. Like there has to, right? Like even our own body, right? Like there's a bunch of examples that keep coming to mind, but you know, that are, yeah, just analogies and examples in nature. But I also see it in humanity, in human history, you know what? And sometimes those periods of darkness and periods of light are at the same time and they're parallel. You know, one of my favorite examples, right, that recently was just discussing with a friend, was they were talking about the Dark Ages, and they were like, the Dark Ages for who? Like, for white people. Mm-hmm. the rest of the BIPOC world, and primarily the Islamic world at the time, there was a golden age at that time. It was on the golden age of Islamic thought and practice and communities that what came to be the light, you know, in the Renaissance period of Europe was based upon. Like, there was nothing, it was all replication of what was already there. Like, the Dark Ages for who, right? So, like, just because it's dark for white people, that's the Dark Ages? No, that was European darkness. Everybody else was different, you know? And the same thing for, like, if there's darkness, if we have societal collapse, right? And we lose what we call normal today, because the oppressors, the colonizers, the police state, the elite don't have their way, does it mean that we can't have our way of a better way of being? Nah, we can still root ourselves in community. And so that's what I hold on to for hope. Like, that's what makes me hopeful, is the fact that, like, not humanity will always, like, thrive, and we just need to connect. We need to just continue to connect, continue to be with each other, continue to recognize our own humanity and root ourselves in relationship. And that's why I do the work I do, right? Like, it's my relationships on a daily basis that's what gives me hope, right? Like, it's that.
Yeah. There are a lot of people here who are listening, right, who are familiar with the mythology, philosophy of Christianity, or Judaism. I don't think we've had somebody explicitly talk about, like, the restorative application to Islam. How has your faith, you know, this being this restorative justice life and your faith being a big part of your life, how does your faith inform your work as a restorative being moving through the world?
In many ways. And the longer I do this work, the more I start to find, I'm like, oh yeah, that was a restorative way of being and this and that. But funny enough, when I was in grad school, I was writing papers on restorative justice. Mm-hmm. from an Islamic law, you know, most people would call Sharia, but Islamic criminal law in particular, and specifically capital punishment. And I was writing papers, and I say very openly now, like, I used to write papers thinking that I knew what I was talking about. I didn't know what RJ was. I didn't know what being restorative was. I didn't know what being, like, no, like, I was writing papers based on, like, some book, like, so, like, it's about being with people and being and doing and making mistakes and reflecting on our existence that makes us restorative, not writing papers and being able to say all the right words and able to spit out facts and know these processes. Like, that's not what makes you restorative. But I would say that's where it started, right? Like, I started writing papers on, like, you know, capital punishment in Islam says that, you know, X person was accused of murder and found guilty of murder, or they confess, right? Like, they're found guilty. in Islamic law, and this is an oversimplification, right? But like they're given a death sentence, but the family of the victims are given priority to say, do you want this person to be punished, or do you want this person to be given leniency and clemency? Would you be willing to accept blood money for them, for their life? And so like there is an intentional, explicit place and space for the voice of the victim or the voice of the victim's family. So like that's one of the big things, right? But a more nuanced and I think a more beneficial and valuable space of like how Islam really guides me and like continues to push me to be more restorative. Like one of the examples is and in Islam, the idea of rights are not individual rights that you have, that you demand of others. The conceptualization of rights is what are the rights that other people have over you. So what rights, and this is something like really simple, right? But if a Muslim sneezes next to me, they most of the time they say Alhamdulillah. And so the right that they have over me is I have to say Yarhamakallah. Like it's an explicit like right that they have over me. Or something as simple as like, if somebody in the community dies and I know of it and I'm able to go to the funeral, I have to go to the funeral. Like it's these like, and there's a bunch of, you know, these, there's one like a prophetic saying that has a set of these, but it's also found in other areas, more nuanced, right? But like the idea of rights being what others have over me as opposed to what I demand of others roots me in what is my relationship with these people? What is my relationship in existence, right? Like, and it goes on and on. You know, I was grateful to have some really good teachers that gave me a deeper, practical, nuanced understanding of Islamic thought and practice. But it all comes down to like, what is my relationship with this person and what rights do they have over me? Like something as simple as, and this is, you know, a common practice nowadays, particularly with our political climate, right? Like people are just cutting off family members, right? But we think that we can just cut family members off. And maybe at times that's necessary to a certain extent, but like in Islam, it's prohibited from you to cut off ties with kin. Like you're prohibited from cutting off ties. You can limit it, severely limit it, but you can never cut off ties. And when you have that emphasis on, or something as simple as like, there's a saying from the Prophet that like one Muslim should not be mad at another Muslim to the point where they're not talking to him for more than 3 days. And so like this nuanced implied emphasis on relationships for me lets me know that like, oh yeah, no, doing restorative work, doing relationship-based work is the right thing to do. Like that's where we're supposed to be rooted in community. We're supposed to be rooted in relationships. That is how we're supposed to be. And so, you know, I would say that's how, you know, my faith informs my practice.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Relationships being at the center, right? This interconnection, both, you know, to your point, so many people come to this restorative work from like the alternative to the thing that's punishment, right? And like you mentioned that, right, when you're talking about like, you know, having mercy or like not taking a life for a life, but it is so much more than that. Those relationships, and you know, the results of that are going to look different in every single situation, in every single context, but you know, those principles remain the same. I'm curious, in your own words, how do you define restorative justice?
I would say putting relationships first. Restorative justice is putting relationships first and a balance of justice, right? Like seeking a balance of justice while practicing and recognizing relationships. Because sometimes it's a relationship between individuals. Sometimes it's the relationship between the individual to community. Sometimes it's the relationship between the community to the individual. or community to community. But it all goes down to those relationships and seeking justice. You know, and justice is when we fail to fulfill the rights of others, right? Like that is what is injustice, is when we fail to fulfill the rights of others, right? So it's a circular, you know, it's a circle. It's just that feedback loop, right? Like, well, we establish justice by establishing rights. We establish rights by recognizing relationships. We recognize relationships. And then we know what, you know, like, so it's like, this is feed of just those three things. So that's how I would define it.
We're now in the questions that I ask everyone. What has been like an oh shit moment as you've been practicing this way, and what have you learned from it?
I would say the oh shit moment was the one that I just had just recently about, you know, circle being this when you're in I hate to even say it like this, but when you're in a good circle versus a bad circle, right? Mm-hmm. It can be therapeutic because you feel safe and you can be yourself, your vulnerable self. You can, you know, be vulnerable. And I had that, you know, just because sometimes just rambling, just talking, listening to other people. And then you start talking and then you say something that you're like, oh, yo, I get it now, right? Like, oh my God, I hadn't processed that before. My obsession with cleaning, I shared in a circle with Becky, you know, probably last year sometime. And I was saying how, you know, I'm like really, not only is that my go-to thing when I'm like stressed out or when I need to kind of reset myself and feel productive again, like when I'm feeling down or I'm feeling stressed or bothered, but also when I see the house is a mess, I need to clean. And I'm pretty like big on cleaning the house on a regular basis. But like, I look at that and when I think about my own home life growing up, my parents didn't have the perfect marriage, but up until like middle school, when I did have a home with two parents, like that is the one thing that they did right all the time, is they kept a really clean home and orderly home. And so it's like, for me, it was like, oh, it's the one thing my parents did right. And then like, afterwards I started thinking, I'm like, yo, that's like some like therapy aha moment that I just had in circle. And I've had several like that. And that is the aha moment, that cumulative, like there, yeah, circle can be therapeutic because it has vulnerability and authentic relationships. And most of the times we spend our whole lives lying to ourselves and we hardly ever reach that point of vulnerability, even with our own selves, to admit some of our own shit and some of our own toxic traits. And I think that is an aha moment that I've had in restorative justice, in particular circle.
I love it. A lot of times when, and maybe I just need to change the intonation of my voice for like, oh shit, like a mistake that you've made.
Oh, a mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. I would say the other side of that vulnerability, of that realness, of that rawness, and that's the oversharing. And that might be like, as of late, I've started to contemplate maybe that's my ADHD. Like kicking in, because I've started to hear like that is a thing that people like actually do when they have that. But anyways, yeah, oversharing. Because sometimes I might like, I second guess myself when I share a lot, and I can share some pretty dark things a lot of times. Like early in our conversation, while I was telling a story of like that high and that low, like I had to stop myself because I was about to share some really unnecessarily dark things about my past, right? And what I've realized is that like, yeah, that's good sometimes, but sometimes people aren't ready to hear that. Like for me, it's normal. Like I can talk about some real dark things like it's nothing, but sometimes people can't talk about that, and that's not right, right? Like, is it right because I'm my real self and I all of a sudden trigger something in somebody else and I like I'm causing emotional harm, I've triggered them, and then like that's not right. And not only that's not right, but the worst part about it is that there are also other people, and you know, I would say like throughout the 80s and 90s we had, you know, that poverty pimping, right, where people were exploiting communities in poverty in order to make more money, right? We still have that, particularly the nonprofit sector. But what I've really noticed as of late is this, what I want to call trauma trapping, Like, people are trapping, are making money, are profiting from other people's traumas and for other communities' traumas on big scales, right? And like, they'll explicitly use the word trauma. And I'm like, yo, like, sometimes I'm invited to places where like people kind of just exploit my own traumatic past. Like, oh yeah, like let's hold up the brown kid who like made it through. And why don't you talk about those hard times that you had? Why don't you talk about, you know, this and that? And I'm like, oh yeah. Like, some people want you to start talking about that. And I'm like, no, like, and it's kind of like, to give an example in outside of like my own self and more in community base, it's what I would say with my descendants of slaves, my Black brothers and sisters in the U.S. And I would say in all the North and South American Caribbean, where history only starts off as slavery, right? Like, it's that trauma trapping. Like, people, like, there's a benefit to them only talking about that trauma, as opposed to like, yo, no, like, Black people were great before that. Like, let's talk about that. And so, yeah, like, that's where I'm coming out of, like, the oh shit is, like, sometimes you have to scale back. Sometimes you have to just shut up and not share things with people, because not everybody, let's be honest, there's some people with ill intent out there. Not everybody's worthy of like hearing your deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's like especially important as a keeper of a space. Like, it's one thing like when you are just a participant and when there's someone else who you trust who's being there, that's just like making like the risk calculation as a human. But like, especially when you're a keeper of a space, like, an important question is like, why are you sharing this right now? Right? Like, for whose benefit, and like, what are the potential risks? That's important. You get to sit in a circle with four people, dead or alive. Who are they? And what is the question you ask the circle?
Oh, four people, dead or alive. You know, I'm going with, this is really hard. There's like a list of like 10 people that just popped up in my head. I'm definitely saying the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I'm definitely saying Che Guevara. I'm definitely saying Paulo Freire. And I'm definitely saying, oh, who's the fourth here? Who are we handing in there? Nietzsche.
And what is the question you ask the circle?
And the question I ask the circle, how can we be better people?
How can we be better people?
I think we can be better people by just seeing each other, recognizing each other. Instead of seeing somebody for, I just recently heard or read this somewhere, that sometimes, like in our, particularly in our personal relationships, we only like to see the version of somebody that we have the most power over. And I'm like, yo, yeah, some people treat me certain ways, or even like, I'll be honest, like me seeing, and that made me think of like a lot of personal relationships, but like my brother, my little brother, I was seeing him as my little brother who had to like school and bring up and take care. And like, nah, you're like this full grown man with your kids and your family and your own set of experiences. Like, let me see you as this beautiful man that I can learn from. Not the one that I have to take care of and I have to teach and I have to school, right? Like, where I'm the teacher, where I have power over. And so I think by just seeing people, seeing their humanity, seeing their wholeness, just everything, like, you know, they could be drunks, they could be murderers, they could be, you know, just whatever, you know, the deepest, darkest person, right? Like, they're still a person and they might have caused some good in this world. They might have something good to say, like, we don't know. And even if they don't, like, they're still a person, and like, I need to see them as that and like elevate them, because maybe that's what they need, right? Like, just to be recognized and seen, because that's for me, like, that's a feeling that we don't often get, is when you're seen, when you're like really seen by somebody else. Like, it uplifts your soul in a way that, you know, for me, it was, you know, my transition to Islam. I still remember, like, I was working at BJ's Wholesale Club. I was a functioning alcoholic at the time, you know, drank 6-7 days a week, binge drinking, like serious drinking. I would not sleep for 3 days on end. But like, I worked 60 hours plus. I took 18 credits in college. I partied. I like took care of my family. I did things. And one day I was drunk slash kind of like sliding into hangover. And so I wasn't able to work. I was just sitting down trying to catch myself. And my coworker was like, yo, when are you going to get your life together? He's like, you're this great guy who works so hard, but like you throw it away with drinking. And I still remember that, like, he didn't say, oh, why are you drunk? Why are you? Then he was like, when are you going to get your shit together? Right. Like, he recognized me as a person, like, yo, you're this, but you're also all these good things. And like, that was a transitionary moment for me. And so I think maybe because it's me being selfish in that, like, that's what helped me see myself as somebody else saw me. I'm thinking that's how we be better people, like recognizing other people.
Definitely. I think like the step beyond that is like then recognizing yourself in them as well.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Yeah, there's way more of us in other people than, and I hate to like bring it right back to Islam, but like there's a verse in the Quran that says, you know, we have made you of different tribes and nations and people so that you may recognize one another. And like, to think that I made you different so that you can recognize one another, like, is to see ourselves in others. So yeah, anyways.
Yeah. Absolutely. I struggle to ask this question across different podcasts. What's like a fictional place or like something in the media like that you've seen that like you wish people really knew this work? For example, when I think of the movie Black Panther, at the end where like Killmonger is like, just bury me in the sea with my ancestors because it's better to do that than be locked up in a cell, right? Like,
yeah.
You know that there's like some kind of restorative bent to the way that Wakandans do like their like,
yeah,
all that. So like, can you think of a situation similar? It doesn't have to be like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but like somewhere like that.
Well, if we're gonna take it there like that, and because by politics I don't just mean like our modern American political system, right? Like, when I think of politics, I mean of like how an individual governs itself in relation to his community and how and what he expects of his community, right? Where I would say, well, I would love it because, and this is, I'm still trying to process like what the infatuation is with, like, my favorite show is The Walking Dead, right? Or Fear the Walking Dead. And it's because it's that post-apocalyptic reconstruction, right? And with lots of like killing and gore and things like that. I'm an 80s baby. He grew up on Alien and Predator and Terminator and Rambo and shit, right? So but yeah, like to see it more explicitly in like The Walking Dead or the Fear of the Walking Dead and how they reconstruct society, that I think would be super dope. Because I think it would make it palatable for people to understand, right? And I think there are, and like there are certain storylines and certain episodes and things like that, where you start to see a little bit of like restorative ways of being, where people are focusing on their relationships to each other, right? Like the relationship to mercy and to the being seeing the best in others as opposed to the worst in others. And there's this idea of like communities and then communities nestled within communities. But yeah, and redemption, right? Like when we think of like Negan, right? Like they didn't kill him and things like that. So yeah, I would say The Walking Dead is probably where I would like to see some more explicit restorative justice stuff going on.
For sure. Love it. And I think like, you know, long-term goals of this work of Amplify RJ being to like push these conversations into like mainstream media where like it's not just a reference in like how to get away with murder on this one episode or like in this one episode of The Shy where these kids got in trouble at school, but it's like, you know, these themes need to be more present for people everywhere to help them imagine like, oh no, this is a way that we can be together. What is a mantra or affirmation that you want everyone listening to know?
It's okay to be me. It's okay to be you. It's okay to be me. Like, that's okay. And it's okay to be me on bad days, and it's okay to be me on good days, and it's okay to be you on good days, and it's okay to be you on bad days. Like, it's okay.
Becky tagged you. Who would you like to tag in on this podcast? And you have to help me, you know, get them on.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the person, man, there's two people who I tag. And they're both local to the Twin Cities. One of them is Raj Sethuraju. He's a professor at Metro State. And he's kind of like the big brother for me for a lot of RJ work. He's like, he's neck deep in RJ work in the community. Everything from teaching restorative justice classes at Metro State University to like, no, I'm doing circle on a regular basis with community, with like brothers who are coming out of incarceration and who just need to be wrapped up in hugs and community, to when things go wrong and like, how do we respond to this? Like he's one of the go-tos. And I think mainly because he's, for me, I've always seen myself of like I cannot, and I'm surprised it didn't come out in our conversations like more explicitly, is this idea of service and servitude and a servant. Like that's how I like deeply root myself, is like, I'm a servant of the community. Like I have to be in service of others. If not, I find myself to be like pretty hollow. So, and I see him and like, he's just in constant service to the community. And for me, like, yo, that's how I want to be. That's how I need to be. That's how I recognize myself. I would say the other person is Sam Coltis. She's actually a coworker of mine. She at two different organizations now. She was at CMRS before, and she's at Legal Rights Center now. She just started like a month ago. She is a young queer woman who like is real and raw and like understanding and expansive. Like, I think that's the main thing, is like expansive in our understandings of humanity. And she's like, helped me like be able to become a better circle keeper and be able to better like just understand things and understand people. And like, I think she's also one of those people who I value because I've allowed to, she's shown me great value because she's allowed me to be vulnerable with her. And show her parts of me and like be myself, and she hasn't judged me, and she hasn't like pushed me away, and she hasn't been like, oh, yo, that's problematic. She's like, no, let's talk about that. Like, what did you say? Like, let's chop that up. Let's break it down. Like, why do you say that? Why do you think that? Like, and so like we go back and forth, and like, you know, even to, like for me as like a cisgender heterosexual male, like to be able to understand queer identity and queer culture in ways that like where I can ask those dumb questions to her has allowed me to like, oh, okay. Like, yeah. All right. I'm understanding that. Like, hey, they have a dumb question. Like, I don't understand this. Right. Like, can you help me? And she's like, oh yeah. Da-da-da-da-da. We start talking. These are two people who I value because they allow me to ask dumb questions. They allow me to be my flawed self. Right. Like, and they've never judged me for it. Neither one has. And for me, that's huge. Like, that's I would say my biggest, I'd say fear is always of being judged, being exposed for being a bad person. It's the weight we carry.
So I look forward to those introductory emails.
Same way
that Becky tags you. Thank you so much for all of your time and your stories, the wisdom that come with all of those things. How can people support you in your work in the ways that you want to be supported?
I think the best way to like support is, I'd love to be able to spend more time doing training with like educators, but not just educators, but also with like social workers. I find them to be very problematic. I would love to see like whole rewrites of like higher education curriculum to include like for, especially for teachers, to include restorative justice requirements, right? I would love to see, you know, something as simple as, you know, like the calling out and like hyping up of like AmeriCorps, right? Of service related projects. but in particular for me, you know, like I just, if you, you know, I like doing my radio show, and I'm always looking to expand and do more circles and do more trainings. And I'm always excited when people call me to help them out with different things.
So where can people get in touch?
So people can either catch me on Facebook or Instagram, Dr. Mendez 83, or you can look for Christopher Mendez. But you could also find Just Us Building Restorative Community on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much again. It was really a privilege. Anything else you want to leave the people with?
Thank you. I just really want to thank you for this opportunity to be able to just share time and space with you and talking.
Absolutely. Well, those are words for me, not necessarily the people, but we'll take it. And we'll be back with another amazing episode and conversation next week. Everyone else, until then, take care.
Thank you, Chris. I really loved when Chris used the analogy that as a restorative facilitator, he sees most restorative interventions as a cast. Like a bone, a relationship can be broken, but restorative justice can help that heal by creating sort of like a support network. I just wanted to add, on the other side of that, just as we nurture our bones and our body, we can nurture our relationships in order to make them less likely to break. Just like the bones in our body, restorative relationships can also be really essential to our strength. How do you build your foundation of restorative relationships really strong? Finally, I really appreciated his hot take about educators and their role. He said that educators should constantly be breaking and bending the rules on a daily basis. When we're working within our education system that needs a lot of work and is not fully equitable at this point, we need to be constantly challenging that every day. How do you restoratively break the rules? As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, rocking our new merch, joining our Patreon, or signing up for a workshop. So many options! Links to everything in the show notes and on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.